Hello, I am Eli Adashi, Professor of Medical Science at Brown University and host of Medscape One-on-One. We are pleased to continue our discussion with Senator Tom Coburn, the junior senator for Oklahoma, and hear more of his views on the ever-changing healthcare scene. It's difficult to talk about Medicare today without mentioning the sustainable growth rate formula and the concern that many of our viewers obviously have about impending cuts to their reimbursements. Two questions. Does your to-be-proposed bill address this issue? But aside from that, where do you see this matter going in the current mix?
Let me answer the second first. Physicians are not going to have a 24 or 27% cut. We all know that. But it shows you the problem of the legislative body trying to handle health care, because the whole reason the SGR was put in was to control health care, thinking that if the physicians were faced with this, they'd make better decisions about how they spent Medicare dollars. That obviously didn't work, and we've been trying to catch up with it. But what I think you can tell physicians is they're probably not going to see any increases in payment for a number, for at least 5 years, I would say, simply because as a nation, we're on our back financially. So I don't think that's going to happen. They may see a small cut, but nothing significant. And as a physician, I can tell you, you know, dealing with Medicare is really pretty easy anymore in terms of getting filing electronically, getting paid electronically, getting paid on time. The question is can you afford to have those rates in your practice? And that's changing all around the country, so the mix is changing. We need to figure out, you know, I've always asked the question, why does the best surgeon get paid the same as the worst? Why does the best internist get paid the same as the worst under Medicare? Where did we lose market forces? And we lost market forces when Medicare came in. You know, we have transitioned from seeing 25 patients a day and doing a great job to seeing 45 patients a day and not doing what we were taught, which was, if you will listen to your patient, they'll tell you what's wrong with them. Well, seeing 45 patients a day, you can't listen to your patient. So we have transitioned to a treadmill where we're trying to pay the bills, and it's highly expensive. And I have all these friends that have gone to concierge medicine, and what they like about it the most isn't that they're making more money, is that they know they're doing a much better job. They're ordering fewer tests. They're coming to a diagnostic conclusion faster and better. And they're educating their patients and doing a lot of work in terms of prevention that they never had time to do before.
In other words, their level of satisfaction overall is much increased.
And the satisfaction of the patients, is better.
Interesting.
So, you know, there's some mix in between there. We got to figure out how to pay physicians right. And I'm not sure the government ought to be setting prices on it. A price-controlled commodity, if it's underpriced, it's overutilized. If it's overpriced, it's marginalized. So what is wrong with letting individuals decide? And, you know, where you have the bad actors, hammer.
To the extent that you're comfortable sharing this with our viewers, how does your vision compare and contrast with the one that was developed by the House through the initiatives of Representative Paul Ryan?
Well, you know, I fully embrace what Paul Ryan's trying to do. There's a couple of givens. One is it won't continue the way it is. So you have two options. You can go to a market-based model where people make choices based on their own best interest and interact with the market. Or you can say, no, we're not going to do that, but we're going to have a fixed amount of money with a growing number of people, and we're going to let 15 individuals decide what the pay is going to be. Well, What the projections are under the Affordable Care Act,
meaning the IPAB or the IPAB Independent Board, Payment Board,
Payment Advisory Board.
Yeah.
Under the projections from the IPAB Board, you will get less than what you're paid for in Medicaid in a very short period of time, 3 or 4 years, because that's what's going to have to happen if we don't change things. So, you know, why would we go there? Why wouldn't we go and say, you know, our country was built, a lot of what we were allowed to accomplish, markets allowed us to do that. And markets aren't perfect. I have no illusions. But they're a whole lot better than a bunch of bureaucrats trying to make decisions outside of a doctor-patient relationship. And I would bet you, in terms of efficiency, overall we'd get better return in terms of health care for the dollars expended versus the way we're doing it today. So I'm encouraged that Paul Ryan would put that out. You hear all the political clamor about it, and they're going to run on it on the next election, but, you know, it really makes sense. It's untruthful to say we're going to continue Medicare the way it is. It isn't going to continue because the money isn't going to be there. Why not make sure we take care of those that are on the low end to make sure they have plenty of money to get what they want? Why don't we make sure you have an option to where you can save some money if you're a smart consumer? And if you're very wealthy in this country, maybe you're not going to get as much help. Mm-hmm. That's not a novel idea. That's a common sense idea that just might work. Otherwise, you know, the Medicare, I talk to these young people all the time. They don't expect to get Medicare. You know what? They're right. They won't. They don't expect to get Social Security. And I don't think they will. So I would embrace what Paul Ryan said. Look, I would much rather individuals ration the care of themselves. You know, here's what I envision. It's not just the IPAB board. It's the Innovation Council, too. And I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yes, the CMS
Innovation Council. But they're going to say what you can and cannot have access to. What new innovation is available to Medicare? Well, that's nothing but a rationing technique as well. So when you say IPAB board's going to say here's where we're cutting spending, and the Innovation Council is going to say here's the limitation on new treatments, I think Americans would probably rather be able to choose that themselves than having a limited number of people in Washington choosing that for them, regardless how well-intentioned they are or good they are. And matter of fact, I know that. I don't think that. I know that, that Americans would like to make those decisions.
Shifting gears now, Senator, to another issue that is obviously on the mind of all physicians and you as a practicing family medicine practitioner as well as an obstetrician gynecologist would be very aware of, and that is, of course, the malpractice challenge and the notion that perhaps we can reform our medical liability situation as we speak. What is your general vision on that matter? Could you support a bill such as the Health Act proposed by Representative Gingrich? Do you think of this as a federal matter as opposed to a state matter? What can you share with our viewers, given really a life experience, both as a practitioner and as a legislator, on a thorny issue?
Yeah. Well, it is a big issue. Defensive medicine costs at a minimum are $200 billion a year in this country. And where you've seen significant tort reform, like Texas, California, and others, Mississippi, what you've seen is not only have you seen malpractice rates go down, but after about 2 years of that, then you start seeing practice patterns change. And it really does. Oklahoma just passed a tort change in my home state. We've been trying to do it for 25 years, where there's a limitation on non-economic damages for every act, not just health care, every act in our state of $350,000. Well, that's going to draw business to our state like crazy, because you know what the game that's being played can't be played on you. What I worry about and as a fiscal conservative, and also kind of a constitutionalist, I worry the first time we put our nose under the tent to start telling Oklahoma or Ohio or Michigan what your tort law will be, where will it stop? In other words, if we can expand the Commerce Clause enough to mandate that you have to buy health insurance, then I'm sure nobody would object to saying we can extend it enough to say what your tort laws are going to be. But then we're going to have the federal government telling us what our tort laws will be in health care. Then what about our tort laws everywhere else? And where does it stop? You know, one of the things our founders believed is that the 13 separate states could actually have some unique identity under this Constitution and can maybe try things and do things different. And I think we ought to allow that process to continue as long as we're protecting human and civil rights. So I'm real happy about what Oklahoma's done. I can't believe any state wouldn't do that. But one of the things is it's okay to fail. I don't like the liability system. I had a bill last year, our Patients' Choice Act, which incentivized the states to change. In other words, if you'll either put up a health court or you'll go to a system where you actually reform it, then we'll supplement your Medicaid payments. In other words, we'll incentivize you to do that. And that's, I think, is the better way to do it. How do we get you to do something that's positive in the long run for your state? You know, when you break down that $800 billion, a quarter of it is us ordering tests we know we really don't need. You know, when I first started delivering babies, we didn't do ultrasounds unless we had a suspicion that there was a problem. And I would tell you that, you know, what's the average pregnancy have today? 4 ultrasounds on it? Mm-hmm. I don't think the outcomes are a whole lot better. And yet, why are we doing that? A good reason that we're doing it is to make sure we don't see something there that, because there's an ultrasound machine, may not change your action and certainly a lot of times won't change the outcome, but now we've documented it. I'm not sure that helps us.
We have indirectly discussed today the Affordable Care Act, mostly through some of the revisions you're thinking of. Are there elements of the Affordable Care Act that you did find useful, constructive, helpful in any way? Could you get behind one or more elements of the bill, or have you found the bill more or less across the board troubling?
As a practicing physician, I find it tremendously troubling, because ultimately what we're going to do is withdraw decision-making between patients and physicians. I mean, that's the long-term direction of this bill. I like some of the accountable care organization ideas. I think we can do things a lot better in medicine if we do them together.
The teamwork
notion.
Yeah,
but the regulations they put out, the 220 pages that nobody's going to want to now comply with, it just shows you what happens. You know, doctors aren't putting those regulations out. Lawyers are. And what we need is some common sense applied. We can take a good idea and make it a disaster up here all the time when we run it through a bureaucracy. And so I think, but look, I actually believe that we're spending enough money in medicine in this country. I think we can get a whole lot better care for a whole lot more people with the same amount of dollars. But I don't think the way we do it, which is central to the Affordable Care Act, is through centralized command and control bureaucracy. I think, you know, it's the same thing you do with children. You incentivize good behavior and you punish or disincentivize bad behavior. And what we need is transparency. We need transparency as to price in healthcare. We need transparency as to outcomes. We need to quit kidding ourselves about what we can accomplish and what we can't. We need real competition in the pharmaceutical industry. Right now, what we're doing is through our policies in this country, we supplement and subsidize everybody else's drugs in the world. American taxpayer does. as well as the American consumer. We ought to be about changing that. If Canada tells us that our companies can only sell at a certain price, we ought to tell them what we'll pay for their lumber. I mean, we've not ever had an aggressive approach as far as pharmaceutical cost in terms of our international competition. And so what happens is we ultimately pay a whole lot more here than everybody else does around the world because we're subsidizing the research and we're subsidizing the ability for the next new product to come online. So there's no question healthcare is broken, but I would put forth healthcare really got broken when the government started getting into it. If you go back and look at where the healthcare inflation started, go back and look to it. It started in the mid-60s after Medicare started, mm-hmm. after we had a system that said somebody else is going to pay for it.
And we've been trying to constrain costs ever since.
Yeah, right. But yeah. But you're not going to, when my purchase, if I go to the grocery store and I purchase the groceries for this week and I've bought an insurance policy that says, here's my copay, everything else, I can go, I'm going to be a totally different consumer than if I know it's coming out of the wad of $5 bills that I have in my pocket that I've got to pay and I've got to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. Well, it's human nature, and we keep kidding ourselves that this is something other than markets. Is it more serious? Yes. Is it life-impacting to a greater degree? Yes. Can we, in fact, trust individuals to make a great decision for themselves, and can we trust physicians to actually go back and do what they're trained to do? My biggest worry is in our educational institutions today is that because the government has now said, here's the limited time you can learn as a resident, we're actually putting these constraints in terms of real practical experience on our residents, and now we're putting constraints on what they can earn. It's not going to be long where you're going to have fewer and fewer of our top minds going into medicine.
As the Affordable Care Act and its various proposed substitutes are being debated in Congress, there's a parallel process going on in the courts, as you know. And while you're not a lawyer or a judge, have you formed an opinion in your own mind as to the constitutionality or appropriateness, at least, of the individual mandate as a principle?
Yeah, I have, and it's probably obvious to you. As I look at our total government, one of the things I've seen is this slow expansion of the Commerce Clause to give the federal government more and more power, which in sometimes it has been good, there's no question. But most oftentimes, the good that has come from it has been very expensive and very costly. Look, if the individual mandate is upheld, in other words, the federal government can't force you to buy something against your will. Mm-hmm. I think the time for our true freedom in our country is limited because there will be no constraints on this Congress or any other. If that's the rule of the day, then we can tell you what kind of car you're going to buy. We can tell you you can't buy a Cadillac, you have to buy a Chevy, mm-hmm. Because we're selling Chevys over here this month, so you have to buy that. I mean, there's just this whole range that mm-hmm. this is such an expansion in the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause was originally expanded over a farmer who wanted to raise wheat for his chickens in Wisconsin, and yet the wheat board wouldn't let him raise wheat. So he challenged it, and he lost. And so for the first time, we had a federal government telling what a chicken farmer couldn't raise his own feed for his own chickens in Wisconsin. Washington said that. And the Supreme Court upheld that. Well, that was the first expansion of the Commerce Clause. And if you look at it, what we've done is we've continued to grow it. And I think as the Commerce Clause has been expanded through an example of the individual mandate, our freedom is less. And so it worries me about the vitality of our republic when we can expand the Commerce Clause to that extent.
On a personal note, if I may, you are a two-time cancer survivor. Mm-hmm. How can we best proceed in dealing with this major worldwide challenge? Would you like to see cancer legislation as part of your legacy? What are your personal wishes and hopes in this arena?
Well, I think, you know, the science is so expanding now, molecular science and genetic science. It's amazing what we're seeing. I guess my hope would for us to be able to redouble NIH funding again, to take it to $60 billion a year, to, you know, to really bring it up there to where we really put the dollars. I was diagnosed with melanoma as a young man, given a very poor outcome. Was fortunate and had great physicians. I had metastatic colon cancer as in my 50s, and you know, had a 50-50 5-year survival. The medicines, the treatments have so improved. You know, 20 years ago I wouldn't be here. So I think I don't want us to specifically tell research scientists what they have to do, because quite frankly, we don't know. Congress doesn't know. What we ought to say is put the minds, put the brains, put the experience, and say, guys, here's some goals. You go do it. And I routinely fight disease-specific legislation up here, because right now we're working at molecular level that has benefits across all sorts of disease spectrums and all courses of fields. And when we start limiting our researchers and our scientists by saying you have to lock down over here, let them go where we can get the best benefit. Let them go where they can see it. So I'd like to see us do that, and we could do that if we would pull in some of the rest of the federal government.
So enabling rather than micromanaging.
Yes.
And if possible, doubling the NIH budget. Yeah. To $60 billion when and if this becomes possible.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
On that note, sincere thanks to Senator Coburn and to you, our viewers, for joining Medscape One-on-One. Until next time, I am Eli Adashi.